Today we're talking about the importance of lore and why you should be doing your research.
Welcome to Passive Aggressive Perception, the system agnostic TTRPG podcast, where we try not to go off on a tangent.
I am Ivan, and this is the John Belushi to my Robin Williams, Steve.
We are pretty funny.
We are so funny. Fun story, John Belushi's death was actually what stopped Robin Williams from continuing to do drugs. I shouldn't have said funny story
funny
before
story,
that.
Funny story, John Belushi's death.
I should not. No, anyway, I should have said fun fact or nugget of information. Yeah, apparently they were really good friends and they were hanging out the night of John Belushi's death. And that is what snapped Robin Williams into eventual sobriety. I miss him. He was a very talented person. So today we do have some news. First and foremost, I want to lead with some exciting news from the website, which is iCastSpells.com.
Hey, you stole my job at the end.
That's true. We'll give you the rest of the social at the end. Right. iCastSpells.com, in case you didn't know, is our full episode repository. We also do some stuff like art posts. We're going to start doing a couple of opinion pieces. We're also working on a whole bunch of really cool TTRPG tools that you can use there. All that being said, it's also a repository right now for our dusty stack items.
It's the wiki baby.
We got a show wiki and it's up at icostables.com. You can see every single game that we've ever had on our dusty stack, or our list of to play games. We also have a bunch of affiliate links. So with the shameless advertising, I just want to say, if you end up liking any of these games, and we have all the information and the images and a whole bunch of stuff about these games on the site, if you like any of these games and you want to get them for yourself, you can use our affiliate links, which is a absolutely zero extra cost to you way to support the podcast so we can keep doing this.
Yeah, in lieu of, or at least until we get our shit together and ever maybe make a Patreon, this is an easy way that if you're going to get the books anyways, you can we can get a couple pieces of coin. Maybe even use them. We talked about maybe using some of that stuff to get some goodies that for future giveaways.
Yep.
So you might get it back anyways.
Yes, sir. And yeah, it's cool. I'm actually using it as a perfect tracker for us to like see what we've actually gotten off the dusty stack. So we got some check marks up there next to like Deadlands and Paranoia and Twilight 2000. So hopefully we can start clearing off that list, even though we know it's going to get longer. It's longer by the day.
We have not done one in a while.
That's true. If you want another Dusty Stack episode, definitely let us know, because we definitely have a whole bunch of stuff that we could talk about.
We haven't pledged anything on Kickstarter since our last Dusty Stack, so I don't know what we'd even ask. What have new games come out?
You funny. Also up there, we've got all of our intros and our outros from each episode listed. So the blank to my blank, and the I hope your next session is the blank yet. All of that stuff is listed under the wiki as well. We also are taking community contributions. If you have anything, a section maybe that you want added to the wiki, or if you've got anything involving a write-up about the show, you can contact us with the contact form on the page, and we'll also get that up and included.
Mm-hmm. If you are an expert in some niche area of role-playing, if you are a con game GM that we're looking to talk to, we want to do some more interviews. And
totally,
that's a cool place to do that. Also, if you have a great intro that we have still not done yet, a pop culture reference we haven't made yet, you better let us know.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, if you're a casual TTRPG content creator or writer or something and you want to get your stuff out there and you want a place to host it, send us that information, and I'm more than happy to serve as a proxy for posting opinion pieces, blog posts, reviews, anything you got.
So. Yeah, if you want to program the VTT thing so Ivan doesn't have to, and he can just put his name on it and face mush you, yeah. Email us.
Got a lot of programming to do. All right, let's move on to some actual news. Very recently, I think within the last couple of days from recording, Free League just released a free version of Merkborg, which is also in our Dusty Stacks on the website. Basically, what this is it's a totally pared down version. It's kind of like the fundamental core rules of the game. Tons of the art is stripped out. The fonts are kind of standardized, so it's not so many wild, wacky fonts in there.
Boo.
Yeah. So I think a lot of the point of this was just making it easier to read for people, like as an accessibility thing.
Yeah, it's not as artistic, but it gets the job done and gets you playing.
Yeah, like I could not imagine having like a reading impairment or something and trying to read that. Because
if you are a graphic designer and, yeah. and you, like you enjoy the art of it, like you may never finish the core rule book.
Yeah. So what's doubly cool about this is that they're actually offering it for free as well. So you can just pick this up if you want to get into some tasty OSR, brutal 80s death metal goodness, and you're into that zine culture thing. Yeah, so next up on the docket, it looks like Roll20 and DM's Guild, Dungeon Masters Guild, have just entered into an official partnership.
Please elaborate.
Yeah, so basically what that is going to boil down to is that content that you get from Dungeon Masters Guild is now going to be essentially portable over to Roll20. You're not going to be incurring any extra fees if you, say, for instance, buy a kind of obscure piece of material on DM's Guild and then feel like you have to purchase that content again to get like the VTT map tokens and the maps and the special tiles and the assets and all that. You're not going to have to do that. So it looks like because they're going to be joined at the hip now, it's going to be a one-time fee. And then anything that has officially supported content is going to be basically available to you on Roll20.
So the VTT content will be rolled into the purchase price of the PDF type stuff that you can purchase from DM's Guild.
Yes, absolutely.
Excellent. The most obvious thing in the world, we're finally getting to it.
I know. I feel like this is like second to just give me the damn PDF when I buy the physical.
Yeah. Any outlet that's not already doing that, like wowzers. Like, come on, man.
I know. I feel like a lot of people are finally picking up on it, but it took a really, really long time. And I don't know if that was just straight greed or if it was just...
You want me to clarify for you?
Yeah.
It's straight greed.
Yeah, I know.
When I became aware that Cubicle 7 back in the day was had an affiliate program like that where you would give, it's called Bits and Mortar, where you as soon as you purchased it, a physical copy, like you got it emailed like ASAP. And that was really attractive way for me to get first edition One Ring stuff
sure.
from a local or at least relatively local brick and mortar
yeah.
and get the PDFs right away. And that makes all the difference in the world for that stuff, you know, because if you're like, I want to read this, I want to consume this, and I might use it on a VTT, and it's maybe like a cost decision or just yeah. a investment of just like more moving parts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It makes me feel much better if I'm not 100% up to using Roll20. But if I got it for free, then like I can bump around a little bit and yeah. not feel like, oh no, did I waste 5, 10, 20 bucks learning this lesson?
Yeah, yeah.
Probably
yeah, yeah.
poorly.
Yeah.
Like that takes away a lot of anxiety for me.
Yeah. And don't misconstrue that this is me saying DM's Guild is like a small organization, but I've noticed that like more indie and smaller organizations and really small publishers were kind of the first to adopt this like digital physical hybrid. I feel like every time I've gone in to get some kind of obscure DDRPG that no one's ever heard of, almost always they're like PDF and physical, PDF and physical.
Yeah.
It's like, and it's the big ones that really don't do it, because how many people out there have bought a physical book from Wizards only to have to go ahead and get it on D&D Beyond mm-hmm. immediately after because you want to be able to have trackable character sheets, yeah, et cetera.
That's such a feel bad. And especially, and we've talked about this in various episodes about like the idea of that the barrier to entry is a real thing often, you know, especially when yeah. you're like a young person just like trying to have this hobby, you know. And like literally like, you know, a high school kid who's just like, man, like every book is $50.
Yeah, dude.
And
yeah.
I just want to read it on a tablet. Like, come
I know,
on.
No,
like, you're genuinely like hurting your own user base.
Yeah.
And this is such free access.
I mean, I'm old school, man. I'm not going to lie. Even if I'm playing online on a VTT or something, I like having a physical book in front of me that I can leaf through.
Our enjoyment of physical books is really what makes us great.
Yeah, you know, I don't get the smell thing. You know how everybody says a new book smells really nice and that's like one of their favorite parts? I like sort of get it, but that to me, that's just such a weird...
Yeah, but well, a role-playing book is like a glossy, like you don't get like...
Yeah, yeah.
You don't get the old paper smell.
No, you that's get not, like the caustic machine
yeah, good.
oil yeah. shitty smell.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't want nose hairs, like that's a quick way.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, yeah. like we're not putting like glossy images on, you know, like an old copy of the Hobbit, you know. That's a whole separate right. version of that book, and that's not, you know, that's like smelling like your toaster oven and being like, oh, I love the smell of a fireplace.
Remember Whoa. When magazines were really popular in like the 90s? Those things always were just like, they just smelled terrible.
Yeah, because it's just basically like chemical paper.
Yeah. Oh man, this is such a weird conversation, but it makes sense. Your olfactory senses are the ones that are strongest in long-term memory, as far as I understand. It's one of the strongest associations to objects that we as humans have with our limited senses.
I wish I didn't have limited senses. I wish I had like 10 senses.
Unlimited senses. The name of our first RPG. All right, let's move on from this. Okay, new news. It looks like Paramount, so big company, is tackling an adaptation of the role-playing game Alice is Missing.
Small art house Paramount is making moves.
For those that didn't listen to that particular episode yet, we interviewed our friend and developer for Narrative Dynamics, Eric Swanson. And Eric Swanson, this was one of his dusty stack items. It's basically a game that is, quote, silent. It's a silent tabletop role playing game. And it follows the story of this girl that's gone missing named Alice. And it's played entirely through text message.
Mm-hmm. So of all the things to pick. Interesting. I don't know enough about the game to know, you know, like what the how much value the story has just as a story. But interesting to choose this like kind of cutting edge RPG technology to use just to use it as a story. I mean, like there's so many things that have been like out there forever, some of which I guess are kind of already like more Hollywood IPs than RPG, you know, settings anyways. But where's the Mark Borg movie?
Yeah, where's that? I feel like anybody that watches those weird parody movies of like the black metal people from Scandinavia are like, that's as close as we're gonna get to actual Merkberg stuff.
Or just like the weirdest like almost mainstream directors.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Where's my Werner Herzog directs Merkberg the movie? Like, bring just, that on.
Just watch a, like a live taping of like a Cradle of Filth concert, and I feel like that's gonna be the best you can get. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, this is really cool. It's always cool when a TTRPG gets adapted. This is the second adaptation that we've talked about in recent history because Cyberpunk Edgerunners is going to be coming to Netflix, which is an anime adaptation of the Cyberpunk role-playing game series.
I hope it works. I hope it's successful.
Yeah, because I feel like it has potential.
Yeah. Oh, no. Right? I'm not saying. I think my default setting is, like, it'll be great. I think part of it is, like, how things are put out now. Like, if you make a you know, kind of like the limited Netflix special six episode arc where it's self-contained. It's not, oh, I hope this gets renewed, or like a movie that just it's an hour and a half and it's you know, who knows if it's put in the right context, not even just specifically this, but like if a kind of role playing to larger audience, like traditional entertainment setting. If it works, like it can definitely like create a lot of buy-in.
Yeah, and the story, from what it seems like, as far as Alice is Missing goes, it reads of kind of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Also, like the weird true crime stuff that everybody's obsessed with, which I'm glad you're listening to our podcast instead of a true crime podcast. Because
talk about niche audience murder podcast. No one's in on that. Yeah. So you're saying you want the David Lynch co-directs with Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
Alice is Missing.
I mean, that would be, I would watch the hell out of that movie. Two of my favorite directors. So that does it for today as far as news goes. But we did have some listener feedback. This is from our buddy that we've mentioned a couple times, Burnell Dan. That's at BURNELDAN on Twitter. And Daniel missed our Getting to Know You episode. Bummer, he didn't get his question included.
Well, should we be harsh and teach them a lesson by never reading it?
No, he's too nice. This person is so nice.
I acquiesce.
I don't have it in me to be rude to this person. He engages all the time on social, and he's just constantly a super friendly person that is a huge supporter of the show. So listen, I'm going to accommodate them whenever possible. But okay, so here's the question. He says, here's one if I may. Who was your favorite in-game character you had in any game?
Well, I've mentioned him before, but Arden Felsner, a.k.a. the Pig, is my all-time favorite character, a member of our OG Shadowrun campaign. He was a member of the Z-Team dubbed so because we were the opposite of the A-Team. We were an absolute abomination.
That's, I remember this now. That's
and
great.
He rode a crotch rocket and his saddlebags were stuffed with C4. And he was a self-taught demolitions expert with definitely some psychological issues for carrying around so much live explosives. And he was definitely, I am a little, you know, more cerebral. You know, I tend to play like faces and support, very like methodical characters.
Sure.
So to play him, who is a person who is definitely like just like a lunatic, capable of anything. I think like honestly, the fact that you didn't play him instead, I think that Arden was definitely more of an Ivan character.
Blow shit up mine. And ask questions later.
Exactly. Yeah. And also just go fast and like it's easier to ask forgiveness than seek permission guy.
Right.
Is not the kind of character I play. And the group was also a bunch of complete goons and super fun. And he was very memorable because he was like so out there compared to the kind of character I play. And because it was kind of a pure, like we really didn't, it wasn't years and years and years into role playing.
Yeah.
It was like our, the one of the very first systems we loved and like my original like high school crew, some of whom we still play with.
That's cool. I feel like we should consider doing an episode on playing against type because I feel like there's a lot of merits to that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I play a certain character when I play a lot. I know you're similar. And then making active choices to not do that, to play against type, I think can really broaden your experience and in this hobby.
For Deadlands, I fair warning, I have considered either doing like exactly my kind of like face character or going way far afield because I have an inspiration based on the main character of a TV show I love that I'm very much considering.
I'm down with it. Tell me what the show is and I'll watch it.
It's The Warrior.
Oh, I've seen that whole series. It's freaking great. I love The Warrior. I think it's just Warrior too, isn't it? The Bruce Lee one.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I meant the show.
Sorry.
That's why I said that.
Another
swear I've seen it.
Another random tidbit of knowledge. Bruce Lee, there's a show called Warrior. I believe it's available on HBO Max now.
Yep.
And it takes place basically right before the passing of the Chinese Exclusionary Act. And so it's a really interesting setting in San Francisco. And essentially, Bruce Lee had this concept because he wanted to do a period piece that conveyed his struggle as a Chinese American trying to make it in this country, in the media biz and all that. And no producer would have it. They said,
no thanks.
Yeah, they were like,
Asian superstar.
Exactly. He wanted to star in it. And they pretty much said, oh, yeah, well, as long as you're doing exactly what we want and just doing your East Asian martial arts on screen and keeping all the white people watching happy, then great. But if you want to take charge of something and be the lead character, they were like, no, no way. And then it turns out that that show got ripped off from Bruce Lee and adapted into the David Carradine show Kung Fu, which if people haven't seen it, it's the snatch the pebble from my hand if you can, young grasshopper, all that stuff got started. He was supposed to play like a half Chinese guy, and David Carradine is like the whitest, like the waspiest person on the planet.
Keanu Reeves in the lead of 47 Ronin.
right. It was very much that situation, which was about like Wild West gunslinging Kung Fu Shaolin monk master, which is a cool concept, but it's very, very sad. This story concludes with the fact that Shannon Lee, Bruce Lee's daughter, is one of the executive producers for the show Warrior. So she brought it back after the death of her father, after many, many years of poor treatment from the industry, and now created this amazing show.
Have I bought you enough time for you to remember your favorite character?
Oh, God, my favorite. Oh, yes. Yeah, the actual question. I'm so sorry, Burnell Dan. Yes, my favorite character was actually an NPC that I ran. And I named him Colbaz because it was a name that I saw in another module. Fair warning, Colbaz was actually just Elminster in disguise for a lot of the campaign. But he was goofy. He had, like, when he was in his goofy state, he had this strange voice that was kind of like the, okay, this, blah, blah. Like, and he was just, like, very, very flippant and silly. But the thing about him was that he was a very, very powerful mage. And that the minute you underestimated him, he would snap. Boom, and go right into, you know, get away from me before I immolate your soul. So it was this kind of like weird duality of a man that was like almost kind of like Mark Hamill, the Joker, but also like really goofy Snagglepuss type character. The reason why I loved him so much is because he was kind of my little deus ex machina. He kept popping in to help the characters whenever they desperately needed it. And of course, he's Elminster in disguise. So he had the power to do this. And so he'd pop in, pop out, guide, but he was also very hands off. Like, I'm not just going to run in and do the quest for you. But he had one of my favorite quirks I ever made for an NPC in any game, which was that every time he sneezed, he teleported.
Were the PCs know that he was Elminster?
They only found out that he was Elminster at the very, very end of the campaign.
So maybe less deus ex machina, more like secret patron.
Yeah. That's actually a really good way to put it. He was more of a secret patron. So, I mean, again, he would show up and he'd be totally silly and he'd talk in kind of riddles and be really cryptic because he had faith that the party could carry forth the mission and be successful without too much intervention. And then he would go, and then as soon as he'd do that, he'd like, boop, blink out of existence.
Well, I got good news for you, Ivan. You're ready to play Tom Bombadil.
Yeah. He was very much a Tom Bombadil character. That's a really good analogy. So Kolbaz, he was my favorite little thing. And then eventually they were walking toward the city that would end their campaign. And they saw Elminster there with a couple of other characters that they thought had perished. And, you know, a famed horse that had vanished at one point in the campaign. It was a very touching moment.
And you don't have a favorite PC because you never play games. You only run them.
Yeah, no, I rarely play them. And honestly, I screw up most of my characters because I try to make things too hard on myself. And then
you love to hamstring yourself at character creation.
Yeah. And then eventually I end up just kind of like acquiescing to other people's desires and what they want to play. And then I sacrifice parts of my character and then they just turn into this big amalgam of like poor choices. And then the campaign dies and then I move on.
Harsh truths. All right. So that was episode 50A. One last question.
Yes, one last question from Burnell Dan. Thanks so much, man. I really appreciate you sending the feedback. And we can talk more about this later.
Get your question in for episode 100.
Yeah, do it now.
Now. Come on.
All right. I feel like we have killed a sufficient amount of time.
I don't think we killed it all. I think it was very useful and illuminating.
Now we can move on to the actual subject matter of the day. Mm. And the actual subject matter of today is lore, why it's important in your games, speculating on why it's oft neglected by some player types, how it can enrich your gameplay experience, and how we consider it a basic tenet of the gaming experience. So another reason that we're having this episode is that, at least in my experience, and it seems like a relatively common trend, when, you know, especially considering there's so much material out there in the world to pay attention to, you can't know everything about everything. So it's a pretty common trend to dive into a system, and this lore aspect, the things that make the setting unique and interesting, can sometimes be neglected by players and GMs alike.
Obviously, to me, it seems kind of conventional maybe that the GM would be more aware of the stuff in that, you know, they probably were one of the driving factors behind the game. Like a GM is just, to me, is just more likely to be the one who just reads that book cover to cover. And in just reading NPCs or reading about challenges and settings and villages and stuff, like, you are going to come across all that stuff. Whereas a player is going to be looking at motivations and archetypes and, you know, like cultures and things like that. So like you get a sense of lore, but you don't get this like wide range of things when you're looking at it from the perspective of, I want to make this single character.
Yeah. And I think that depending on the degree to which you either ignore or pay special attention to the lore of your setting, can have real and significant impacts on the game. We've got some examples of that, and I think player archetype also plays into that, which we'll touch on a little bit more.
So I want to dispel one, to me, like potential common misconception, which is that there are really kind of like settings in games that just kind of don't have lore or lore that matters, right?
Yeah.
But let me tell you, every game has lore. It's just how front of mind it is and how much are your players going to access it. Because the GM, if they got it, they're probably going to access it. It's got a lot of uses to the GM. It's translating that and getting the player buy-in. Because even a set, you have a very rich existing IP. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do a whole lot of world building for Middle Earth or, you know, these existing expansive IPs. You don't have to take a like well padded out D&D setting because it's there for you. What you have to do is consume it and then create challenges or players create their story within it.
Yeah.
But even the games that like Fate or like some Burning Wheel games where sure. you kind of like you create that as the table. Well, you're creating that, like what you make to kind of decide, like, here are the truths of this world or the setting. Here is the place we come from or the place we're going, or here is the overarching whatever. What you're making as a collaboration at the beginning in your session zero or whatever is exactly that lore. It's the history that matters. It's the existing situation that matters.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's kind of where I wanted to start with this entire episode was like, let's spend just 2 minutes defining what we mean by lore, because I feel like that has connotations. When you say lore, right, people think of like, oh, let's talk about the myths and lore of a thing or particular stories. As a for instance, if somebody were talking about Greek culture and you say the lore of Greek culture, that person might think, oh, the Greek pantheon, Greek myth. That's not necessarily what we mean by this. In my eyes, at least, it's the cumulative knowledge that doesn't necessarily affect game mechanics that make up the world and setting in which you're playing.
Right. It doesn't have to be ancient. It doesn't have to be this huge tome of all these things from eons and ages and generations ago. Lore could be from an important thing that happened 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's important and it's part of the lore.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no kind of like whatever the opposite of expiration date is for like this. It has to be very old and super relevant.
Yeah. And I think that that hits on the very first point of why I think lore is such a fundamental part of the gaming experience is that what happened in the past. I know this is such a dummy speak, but it's needs to be said. What happened in the past affects the way people live their lives in the future. Right. If a city or a kingdom was sacked 10 years ago, and now the current setting in which you're playing is dealing with the fallout of that city or kingdom having been sacked, that's an important thing to know to inform the decisions that you're going to be making in your game.
Right. There's value in all settings lore. It's just a kind of a sense of like percentage.
Yeah.
How much do the players have to read 150 pages of the history of everywhere in your setting? Do they have to just know the very basic truths and the kind of the room in between there,
right?
Because some settings benefit from deep lore and others not so much, but everyone benefits something,
right?
And how lore affects your game is where the hooks come from, where motivations for NPCs come from, or motivations for PCs, really, especially mm-hmm. if, I mean, you want like something grounded in your world, make your players' motivations couched in history, couched in the lore that matters there. So there are systems, to me, it reminds me of like Simbarum, we've talked before, where there is, the book starts with lore. It doesn't start with the basics of the game.
Yeah.
It doesn't start with what is the dice system in this game. It doesn't start with character creation. It starts with an admittedly chunky section of the book that walks you through basically really kind of the way back in the day, fall of Simbar. And the like the shit that matters that's happened in like the last 25 years.
Yeah.
And it's expansive, but it's because this is a deep lore setting where everything seems to grow out of that chapter.
Yeah. I mean, even talking about Merkborg again, since we've mentioned it so many times this episode, that game is essentially almost entirely lore. It's a small book and the mechanics are very, very simple. But between the mechanics and all the items and stuff you can get in that game, it's a limited section of the book. And the rest is just brief paragraphs and examples of lore for each little piece and tendril of that setting in which you're playing.
Yeah, sometimes it's there's density, right? I mean, it could be a 10 page primer at the beginning of a book. But that just means that these things are so key and so baked in and so important that like, we can get everything across in 10 pages, but like, please pay attention to these 10 pages.
Yeah. And I mean, this is what people fall in love with. I just want to give like kind of like a provocative example of this. I don't give a shit about D&D. Now, I'm not saying I don't love D&D. What I'm saying is D&D without the Forgotten Realms for me, because I'm a Forgotten Realms fanboy, isn't much. It's just a system of mechanics to properly roll dice. So when I sit around fantasizing in my room and think about myself as a grand hero embarking on some acts of grand gallantry, I don't think about, oh man, I cannot wait until I get to roll my D20 plus the D6 plus the modifier mechanic that allows me to enhance my abilities. I imagine the setting. I imagine the rich history of the world. As somebody who plays a ton of stuff that's not D&D, I still go out and collect all the Dritzed figures. You know what I mean? I don't even like Funko Pops, and I have all the D&D Funko Pops.
I think that you, correct me if I'm wrong, but your favorite part about Elminster is that some of the things he has double proficiency bonus in.
Exactly. When I talk about Elminster and how much I love Elminster, I'm not talking about his double proficiency bonus. I'm talking about the things that make him he is, and the setting in which he grew up is a huge part of that, which kind of leads me to my next point, that like, if you're a player in this setting, barring the extra ridiculous, like you came from another plane of existence or you dug your way out of hell or something. Well, actually, the existence of hell is part of the lore.
Even then.
You're supposed to have lived in this place for your entire life. So even if you're player doesn't know this knowledge, your character's supposed to. So without paying special heed to the lore of your setting, how are you supposed to play your most genuine character in that case?
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be a history professor to be an American who's aware of like landmark moments in history,
right,
and how
right.
those impacted a relatively young nation, you know? And you may not have this professorial level information. You may not see it from like philosophical standpoints, but you understand the basic reasons why it matters and how it interacts with things and why people's motivations grow out of things like that.
Yeah.
Why people have the values that they have. And so that stuff is things that like you don't need to make a history check for the things that you're that everyone knows because it's just there. It's
right.
present.
Right.
You didn't have to read that huge paragraph, that huge chapter in the book to understand like the fundamentals, where they came from, who the big players were. That's lore.
Yeah.
You know, but like fundamental truths are just there. And the lore kind of builds on top of that.
Yeah.
I think one of the pitfalls of not using lore to its full extent or to get the most out of it is that you can strip a setting of its uniqueness.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
difference between lore is what means is what makes a fantasy setting Faerun or Hyperborea or Middle Earth instead
yeah.
of just fantasy setting Go. It's
yeah, yeah.
what makes a cyberpunk game Shadowrun or Cyberpunk Red or Blade Runner instead of just dreary cybernetic arm setting, you know, like any other one. Like what how the kind of this dystopian situation came about, where like what stage of it is, you know, like what stage the technology is affects a lot of decision making and a lot of the challenges and some of the complications of that cyberpunk world or that fantasy setting. Like it can be as simple as high fantasy, low magic, all the way down to literal Faerun.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you say it could strip it of its uniqueness, and I agree. I mean, you can certainly play a game, and we know that there are gamers like that that get great satisfaction out of playing the game in a very straightforward way. I feel like a lot of the OSR community kind of adheres to these ideals a little bit, and a lot of other people that I play with personally, regularly. That being said, without some context, and I know this is on the bingo card because at Passive Aggressive Perception, context is king, but without that context, a game is just a pile of mechanics. It might as well be a mathematics textbook.
And it feels like to me that if you are not embracing the lore, like you're doing so much more heavy lifting. You are coming up with these convoluted reasons why it should affect the players or how to get them hooked into a storyline when if you just leverage the existing lore, it's right there. You know, like when we first started playing Blades in the Dark.
Yeah.
It was still in its infancy as a game and like not all the material was there, but we had the basics to explain like this is why you can't leave this city.
Yeah, yeah.
This is why like you're kind of stuck in a life of crime. Because if you are just like, well, why don't we just go on the straight and narrow? Or why don't we go to another city where life is easier? You understand why you're forced into these decisions and you understand why the challenges that confront you exist. Because if you don't, then it's just kind of like, okay, another thing that's beating us down, right, like kind of, right. You know, it just becomes this kind of like nihilistic exercise of like just kind of getting to the next day or just ramming your head into yet another obstacle. I don't know why. Why are these baddies always at us?
Yeah, and I think you actually raise a really good point that the absence of lore sometimes can be a driving hook in and of itself. I think not understanding the full history of something important, and I'll go back to the Simbarum example, but in Simbarum, you do not know where ogres come from. We do not understand their reproductive patterns. We don't know how they're made. We don't understand. They just come out of this big, deep forest at one point. And
with amnesia.
With amnesia. Yeah, no recollection. And they come out seemingly fully grown. That lack of lore, that lack of fundamental understanding of the setting led us, even in particular, to investigate. That absence of lore drove us in that game to try to learn more about the world in which we live so that we could improve our general knowledge base and thus improve our game.
We also talked about in kind of the idea of, you know, whether this was worth kind of diving into as its own episode was the idea that like there's this maybe not doing the, you know, doing the heavy lifting and like really, you know, just as a player coming to the table with at least a working understanding of the lore of this world. And to me, like to kind of ignore it or sometimes I think that there's a positivity put on sometimes people who say, I want to learn the lore as a player, as I learn it as a character, which to me is like kind of a cop-out sometimes. Like I feel like when you are just tuned out to the lore at that and you kind of trample on a setting's important aspects, that is to me almost kind of proto-racist. Like to not give a shit about what makes the setting tick or why the people who aren't your character care about things, why they are motivated by what they are, is just very dismissive in character of things that matter to other people or things that make them different than you.
Yeah, exactly. And again, just to clarify, if I'm understanding this right, when we say that we're thinking it's like proto-racist, we don't necessarily mean that the person sitting down at the table is an insane bigot. What we mean is, think about it through the lens of going to a country or a culture that you know very little about, making no effort whatsoever to assimilate or learn anything about that culture or even just its basic etiquette. And then you go to a restaurant and you do something considered extremely offensive to someone. Now, mistakes happen, right? It's impossible to expect everyone to know anything. But unless you show a modicum of effort to learn something about the culture that you're supposedly immersing yourself in, there's kind of like hubris to that. They're saying, oh, whatever, my way's the only way. You know, you're in America, talk American.
Right, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Why these things matter to you is not important to me because it's not important. Right. Because it doesn't, it's not a motivation of mine. We don't share this, so I'm not putting the energy into caring.
Yeah.
It's the expecting someone in a different country to speak English to make it easier for you.
Right,
it's
right.
Walking through the middle of a parade because you don't celebrate what's being celebrated in that parade.
Yes.
It's yelling into your cell phone in a religious building,
right,
because
it's
not your religion. Why a village might care about about the feelings of a god that you don't care about is that has negative connotations in character.
Yeah. Oh, don't touch our holy effigy and then you go pee on it or something because you're drunk.
Right. Like say there was like a holy vessel of water inside like a walled compound and you just stick your ass in it. Not that any characters in my Simbarum campaign did that.
You're still so salty about this. True story, folks. True story.
Kiss my ass. I think that to me, Simbarum is a good example of that, too, in when we talk about like settings that value the lore. Because, again, like I said, this book starts with a chunky chapter about lore saying this is really important. And I think that as running a Simbarum campaign for me for the first time, I understood the lore and maybe I didn't do as good a job as I should have impressing the scope of this lore and how this would really drive a campaign, even a short campaign, because deep lore worlds or even lore worlds that have certain lore that's important, that drives decision making.
Yes.
It drives the kind of the open world feel. Like if you don't understand the lore, if you don't understand what's important in the world, then if you turn that decision making open over to the characters whose players don't have that knowledge, like that means they have flimsy or lacking goals or choices. If you
Absolutely.
Don't know why you would do things, if you don't know why you would have goals or motivations, then like you don't have, you're robbing yourself of agency. And the GM can rob you of agency too.
Totally. And I mean, identifying things in a culture, right? The history of injustices or the boons of a particular civilization, it absolutely informs the scope of the actions that you're doing. I mean, it's just another additional layer of meaning to make what you're doing not just freeform performance art at the table, right?
I think the game is worse off if you're haphazardly filling in these blanks or freestyling lore. Like if it's important and it's historical, if it rises to the level of quote unquote lore, then like sometimes you have to have a little more care than just this is the name of the god, the number one god. Here's a little bit about the war that set the table for 1,000 years of culture.
Right. Yeah.
The schism.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to be tough to, like, come up with why the schism happened and give it gravitas if you're just like, it was because what's on the tip of my tongue? Whatever. You know, like that to me, you're not giving it like the proper attention or the proper effort when you're something that's supposed to be important is maybe done in a way that's lacks the proper care.
Yeah. And I just want to even talk about baselines here. Now, I want to clear all this up by saying we know that learning lore and deep diving into the myth and legend of a setting is difficult and time consuming. There's no GM on the planet out there. And if they do, then I apologize. But there's no GM on the planet out there that's expecting you to know every minute detail of the setting in which you're playing. But I think coming in with a healthy baseline is not only going to improve your game, it's also just a matter of like respect. Now, let's talk about the fact that if your GM is running a homebrew, right, and they've given you materials and you've paid no heed to them, that would be extremely disrespectful. Anybody could see that. Now, when somebody gives you a player's handbook and it has the same lore in there, but you choose to disregard it, how is that any less disrespectful than if it was created by the GM themselves?
Yeah, there's definitely a bit of a social contract involved in this, too. Like, really, it kind of starts with that social contract, right? We choose this game because we want to explore the setting, or we choose a game that lets us kind of build a bit of the important things about a setting. But from the jump, that stuff has value, and you cannot just completely ignore it or like very or drastically marginalize it and expect to have even close to the same experience of someone who has, you know, an average working understanding. You don't need to have written the Bible about Faerun to understand the highlights and the important parts so that you can enjoy the game from even a kind of a medium level and then grow from there.
Yeah. I mean, Faerun is actually a really good example. Let's think about Waterdeep. I mean, one thing, I know I talk about this module quite a bit, but I actually really enjoy it. The Waterdeep Dragon Heist, they have like a listing of pertinent laws and stuff. And then you've also got like the Waterdeep and Caridian, which you can go in the back and you can learn all about the particular festivals of that city and why certain things matter and the history of it and why there's giant statues all around. This is all perfectly available to you. And if you don't use that, right, you could very easily potentially walk into Waterdeep, commit an egregious act, a crime, without ever even knowing it's a crime. And I know this is a very practical example, but the point is that by staying abreast of all this information, this lore, you're reinforcing the fact that you're not going to bring in your own real world assumptions into your make-believe setting. I'm not going to come in and assume that spitting on the street isn't a crime and that it's not a horrible thing to do when in this setting, that's the greatest sign of disrespect in the entire culture.
And that's something that can happen in real time, too. Your interest in asking the questions, you know, what are maybe some of the, we're new to the city. Our characters are new to the city.
Sure.
I don't want to commit any faux pas. Is there any thing that we need to be aware of that is just like kind of common knowledge. Like before my character commits some kind of hate crime on accident.
Yeah.
Like, give me a heads up, or like, give me the rundown, the basics that we would need to know. And that's embracing, you know, educating yourself in and out of character. That's a good faith. That's a good faith effort to say there are things that matter here that I don't know. Like, I want to know some of them, even if it's just so that I can play my character the way that I want to, in a way that I will get satisfaction from, and that like the story will be better. Our collaboration will be better.
Yeah. I'm actually really glad that you brought up the exposition dump, because I think that's an integral part of this conversation, is that much like when you're playing in a game with a GM that might not be 100% on the rules, maybe it's a new system, or maybe, you know, you're rules lawyering and you just need to confirm something about a kind of obscure nuanced rule. Every time that GM has to open that book and spend 3, 5, 6, 8 minutes reading down that rule set and reconfirming all this stuff, is time that's out of your game that breaks the flow of the session and that can sometimes make you miss the important story beats. Having to do an exposition dump on your players is exactly equivalent to this. It's a one-on-one. Maybe if you're really good at spinning a yarn, you can get away with it being a fun aspect of the game. But more often than not, when somebody says, oh, I don't understand why there's all these statues around, I don't understand why everybody's dressed this particular way, and then you have to stop the session and say, okay, well, allow me to be the librarian and talk about all the things that you should have known because it was in the source material, but you didn't read.
Statue tour guide.
Yeah.
Well, there's kind of a way to have a player / character mitigate that too. And that is the archetype lore master, not the capital L, capital M, GM, another word for a GM.
Right.
A GM can leverage the player who loves to be the lore master.
Yeah. I mean, going on about player archetypes, not character archetypes like mage or fighter, we're talking about types of players. We know there's the gamist, there's the metagamer, there's the power gamer, there's the role player. There's all these different player archetypes. I guess this would qualify as kind of passive aggressive perception tip number one of the episode is that, yeah, why don't we consider the lore master a new one of these player archetypes? If there is at least one person at the table that is willing to do the deep dive on that lore, is willing to learn about the things that make this setting unique and important, they can shoulder some of that burden for the other players that might be less inclined to do their research, in the exact same way that if a fighter takes a whole bunch of combat skills, that's going to free up other players to take more role play pertinent skills or take more social interaction skills. It's kind of like a party balance conversation. But in this case, it's kind of sharing that burden of, as we talked about before, rules learning. But in this case, lore learning.
Yeah, it reminds me of kind of like an anthropologist, or like the kind of the classic bardic knowledge. You know, there's just the person that's going to be like, okay, guys, we're going to New York City, and here's what you need to know while we're in New York City. Here's the power players. Here's why some of these things are what they are. Here's the hot button issues of the day.
Sure, yeah.
Like, they can clue you into it without feeling like it's the GM lore dumping on you or speechifying and slowing these things down. If they're doing it in character, like, that's a great way to split that in half and kind of take away, one, takes away a little heavy lifting from the GM, but also then it doesn't feel like the players are being talked at.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a conversation. It's imparting wisdom to the members of your merry band.
Yeah, and I mean, it opens up great roleplay experiences. I took on this role in Simbarum, the game that we played, and I was essentially a lore master that carried around all these texts and scrolls and things from an ancient civilization that I referenced all the time, and I was the person that people would reference or talk to or ask if a cultural question arised. And I mean, I got great satisfaction out of that, because that allowed, I mean, I was completely useless in combat. But that allowed
99% useless.
That allowed me to play a role where people would be like about to go do a thing or talk. Why is that this way in this city? And they would like drop some kind of like question that could easily turn into an exposition dump. But instead, I was able to chime in with my character, turn that into a role play experience, and it turned into like a group communal learning experience for everyone as well.
I definitely remember there were situations too when like we would encounter barbarians of the forest, and sometimes like what tribe they came from would clue you in, like whether they were friend or foe.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
Why didn't, you know, what not to tread upon, or like a beastie comes along and you're like, this is one we need to run from, or like this is its Achilles heel, you know, like you can impart the kind of stuff that anyone could know, but as long as someone knew it and could clue everyone in, then there's the value of the lore manifesting right there.
I think that there's merit to the argument that I want my story to be emergent and I don't want to learn too much of the setting, and I wish more of that burden were shouldered by the GM. And I think that there is merit in that. That's definitely a play style, and that's definitely a storytelling archetype. That being said, I think that there's a lot to be said for targeted learning. Me being a barbarian in a specific culture means that I, as a player, am going to try really hard to commit to memory the things that I would know as a barbarian. Now, I don't have to learn every last piece of lore in that book, but the things that my character would know, it's very useful to deep dive on that information. So exactly, if we get into a situation like that, I can tell if the Byaga clan is friends with the other clan, or whether or not we have really deep-seated feudal hate for each other.
Right. To me, there's very little difference in a player reading up on the combat rules that are relevant to their fighting style as the lore relevant to their culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, for me personally, I can't even get into the headspace of somebody that doesn't want to do that. But when I know I'm going into a new campaign, I spend the next 2 weeks reading everything. I know we're starting a Deadlands campaign in the next few weeks or next month or two. I've read 2 Deadlands novels before then. I've read through all the supplemental material. I've reread and done a synopsis of all the lore, both pre-Morgana and after Morgana effect. And I'm going to forget it all, I'm sure, when we play the campaign, but I now have a much better baseline.
Nah, it's riding a bike. It'll all start manifesting itself properly. One thing I want to reinforce too, and hopefully we've made this apparent tonight too, is that this is not like griping like, oh, the players don't do it and the GM does all the I read those 150 pages and you didn't, like, so you know, like that, like you specifically finger pointing are like leaving us short on how good or bad this campaign can be. What we're saying is that, again, like everything, this is a team effort.
Yeah.
And there's things that all of us should be putting some effort into. You know, no one's going to show up at like a hack and slash game and be like, I just don't know how initiative works. Like, there are tenets that you want to have. And lore to me is a tenet enough that like everyone should have an amount that they've done, that there shouldn't really be kind of going like a going cold.
Yeah.
And anyone, GM, player, anything, like, you're going to work together better if you have more touch points of lore that you all understand. There's less, the learning curve is different. There's just way less exposition and like filling in of these things that that could very well already be known. And then it's just there and you can play instead of feel like there's going to be a quiz at the end of a session.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, in my eyes, it's very low effort. I won't say very low effort, depending on the density of the lore, but it's low effort and very high reward. And the risk you're taking by not getting a baseline of lore knowledge before you start a campaign is pretty big. I mean, I think one of the worst things that can happen is, without that context, without that understanding of the world in which you're playing, you can very easily get bottlenecked back into playing tropes. So like you said, generic fantasy setting A, generic fantasy setting B, what makes them different? If I don't know, I'm just going to enter into that and I say, there's a thieves guild. I guess I'll just do the same thieves guild quest line and plot points that I've done in my last 6 campaigns, without understanding what's going to make this particular campaign unique and more interesting, or at least as interesting as the last time I did that same exact thieves guild quest.
Yep, absolutely.
All right, so I hate to promise this, but I feel like this is going to be another conversation. I know for a fact that we have a lot more to add to this, and I know that there's a lot of probably much smarter people out there that would love to chime in. So I'm going to wrap it up here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to pass it over to Steve, and Steve is going to go ahead and give you our social information so you know how to get a hold of us and talk about all your experiences with lore.
So the place you want to start is iCastSpells.com, which is where you're going to find all the episodes, the wiki, the dusty stacks, the contact information, and you can get a hold of us in plenty other places. You can check us out on Twitter at @passive_podcast. You can email us at passiveagropod@protonmail.com. We're on Facebook, which is where you're going to get notifications that we drop new episodes, and it's where you can share and interact if you're not on some of the other socials. We're on all the podcatchers. Let us gently nudge you towards the ones that let you rate and review, because that gives us a lot better metrics. And it puts us out there in front of more people so we can have bigger and better conversations with more people.
Yes, sir. And that about does it for us today. You have been listening to Passive Aggressive Perception. I am Ivan. This is Steve. Thank you so much for spending this time with us again this week. And we hope that your next session is the most historically significant one yet.
I love the two-word ones. It will be.
So extra. Just a little extra flair at the end.
We're not one word.